back to Old Taku no Radio. I am Jared, Southern Correspondent for Anygamers. I guess Chief Southern Correspondent, because we don't have any other Southerners there yet, but maybe one day. Joining me, as always, is the wind beneath my wings, the wonderful Drunken Otaku himself, Ink. Say hello, Ink.
Hi.
He may have had a little sake.
Just a little bit.
Just, you know, enough to be appropriately on brand. So today we are talking about the 2007 anime series Moribito, Guardian of the Spirit, which is based on a young adult novel by Naoko Uehashi and features animation production via Production IG in the directorial hand of Kenji Kamiyama of Ghost in the Shell, SAC, and Second Gig fame, as well as Eden of the East fame. Great director. Love the guy, especially Eden of the East. Moribito. So the bodyguard is a woman by the name of Balsa from a distant land, a very mountainous, unforgiving land called Kanbal. And she is a traveling bodyguard of some fair renown. She is known as Balsa the Spear Wielder by most people who know of her, because she is basically a master with the short spear. And the Second Queen calls upon Balsa after Balsa sort of happens upon the Second Prince and saves his life, saves him from drowning. That turns out to be an assassination attempt, and the Second Queen takes the opportunity to thank Balsa by inviting her to the palace, which is an offer she can't refuse, and then giving her another offer she can't refuse, which is, please save my son from the Emperor. He's trying to kill him because he has this water demon in him that's in an egg form right now, and they're going to have to sacrifice him to get rid of the water demon. And that's the basic setup. So Moribito, like many fantasy stories, is a journey story in a lot of ways. It's a journey in a sense in that eventually Chagum, the second prince, is going to have to go to a place and do some stuff, and we'll talk about that later, to deal with this water demon, which is more than it appears to be. In a lot of ways, besides that, though, it's a story about family, and it's a story about the family you choose rather than the family you're born with. And
also about the family you earn.
Yes, that's an excellent way to put it, because it really is more like that. What, unpack that a little bit for us, Hank.
The series has such complex characters, it takes a lot to unpack that statement. You have Balsa, the bodyguard, who was raised by a man, not her father, because of her father's good intentions, which defied the king at the time's request to his loyal elite. And that is a great parallel to those who hunt Balsa down currently. Or at least the beginning of the series. Balsa is initially an orphan, though she doesn't know it. She travels with a bodyguard and witnesses her bodyguard's death and becomes acquainted with a fake brother or an adopted brother, sort of an adopted grandmother who's a magic wielder. Her adopted brother is a medicinal healer who takes after the grandmother. And after she grows up, she becomes this bounty hunter. She becomes Chagum's protector and reunites with her brother and the grandmother to form this very tightly knit familial unit because of their history, with the addition of this prince, who now represents the child. And all this is done through fate, through choice, a really unique blending of fate and choice, actually.
it's one of the most beautiful family stories I think I've ever encountered in anime.
It is. And it just works so well because they don't really try to tell it. They just let it form. All the pieces fall into place so easily.
So I think we mentioned a little bit ago that this is based on a young adult novel by a novelist by the name of Naoko Uehashi. And I want to take a moment, if we can, to back up and talk a little bit about the background of the source material for this anime, this is not a light novel. This is an actual novel. It is a story that, it's a fantasy novel, basically.
It's described by the author. It's described as a young adult novel.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's not light novel, but it is not quite novel.
Yeah, that's one thing for sure. It's not this is not like, Lord of the Rings kind of size work, right? The book that this is based on is also called, in English, it's called Moribito, Guardian of the Spirit. And it's actually been translated into English. And you can buy this book either in hardcover or ebook form from Amazon or your favorite retailers. And I highly recommend it. It's interesting in a lot of ways. And I'll talk about the differences between the anime and the book a little bit later. But this is the very first book in a series of 10 volumes that kind of give this entire overarching story. But Moribito, Guardian of the Spirit, being the first one itself, is a complete story.
Shouldn't it be called Guardian of the Spirit? Because Moribito is the Guardian of the Spirit.
Yeah, which the Guardian of the Spirit that's named in the for the book's title is actually referring to Chogum, because he is the actual vessel carrying the egg around. So one of the things we find out later is this is not a water demon that he's carrying. It's in fact a water spirit that is essential for the survival of the people of Shin Yogo, and which is the country where this is all set. And the challenge becomes this water spirit has to come into the world or there will not be rain, and everyone will die because there will not be food. But the conflict for Balsa and Tanda and Madame Torugai, who we've kind of mentioned up until now, is how do they make sure that the spirit's born and that cycle continues, because this happens every 100 years, and how do they do it without Chogum being killed? Because eventually there will come a time where these monsters from the spirit world, which they call Nayu, will come for him and literally rip him apart, trying to eat him, basically. And as a side effect of that, they spit the egg out, and that's how the egg gets picked up and how the circle of life continues, so to speak. So one of the things I love about the story is it twists and turns in these wonderful ways, and the moral dilemmas that the characters face throughout, not just Balsa, but even people in the Imperial Court who are trying to first kill Chogum because they think it's the right thing to do, and then they learn, that's actually completely backwards and wrong. We have to save him, but we've got to get him back. And their conflict about how to deal with the problem, it's really interesting to see the characters kind of go through this sort of tortured, soul searching, trying to figure out a way to save the boy and save the world as well. One of the really cool things about it.
What I actually liked is it wasn't that tortured. There was a sense in this universe that the Stargazers, who are seen as sort of the most learned advisors to the court. These are the people who are inheritors of the knowledge of old and sort of direct the policies of the court through the past. They are preachers of the knowledge they know. Unfortunately, as is divulged as the series progresses, that knowledge is not necessarily correct. The Star readers have been sort of political servants, in a sense, where they are made to advance the state of the state, not the state of knowledge. And I love that sense of corruption, the fact that knowledge isn't meant to serve knowledge and progression, but to serve politics. And certain figures in the series become aware of this, and as they do, I love the reactions, because not only the people who discover this knowledge are turned, but in turn, the people who have been proponents of the old knowledge, and then the people who rely on that old knowledge in turn. It's a series that shows humanity's want for the quest of truth and legitimate being. They just want to be in the best way possible. And as they discover new knowledge, or at least artifacts that relay possible new knowledge, they constantly question their own, and they go, oh, hey, this may be better than what I have been doing. And then they take steps to correct it. Even the violent, even the violence stops when they take into account, oh, now we don't have to kill the prince, or now we don't have to kill the protector, we just have to find a way around it, because we found this piece of evidence.
And that's so not anime, isn't it?
No, like, it's not.
That what normally you get in your average anime is that this information has been repressed by some malevolent or conniving political force within a royal court, and you're going to have some jerk face who's, you know, going to be actively trying to repress people from finding out the truth, and it's so different from what you normally see in kind of the paint by numbers sort of plots you get in anime quite often. And to Ink's point, you know, everybody in this show is trying to do the right thing. They don't always agree on what the right thing is, but you're with all of these characters enough to know, whether it's the young Star reader who was the tutor for Chogum, or whether it's the secret regiment warrior guy who had an encounter with Chogum when he was very young and was deeply touched by Chogum's generosity. You know, these are two characters that I think highlight sort of they're desperate to try to figure out what the right thing to do is, and desperate to help Chogum if they can. And just seeing that happen on all fronts and on all sides gives the story overall this sort of innocence, in a way that is, you know, with a lot of the crap going on in the world and a lot of the just, you know, mediocre routine, you know, political intrigue plots you see in anime, it's so nice to have one that just does not play by that rule book at all.
I completely deplore that term nice, but totally agree. There's this excellent moral grayness. It's not good or evil. It's just a battle of understanding as to an overall inclination as to do what is right, not just what feels right.
It's kind of legalistic in a way, because they're very concerned with what the actual correct rules are. You know, like everybody wants to figure out, like, what is the correct way to do this?
They're legitimately only concerned about that because they want the prince to survive, and everyone wants the prince to survive for certain reasons. The emperor wants the prince to survive because the state. Balsa wants the prince to survive because he is her charge and her salvation to a certain extent. And the, you know, every other character has certain designs on this kid and his survival. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that it all plays out without an overextended monologue or dialogue about it. It just plays out. People are who they are and act to their station. And the grand narrative that is this Second Prince's involvement in the spirit world and future destiny largely goes unsaid, as does his development. Because he's kidnapped as this little kid who's, you know, this sheltered child of the court. And all of a sudden, everything is stripped away just to live this road buddy life with Balsa. And, you know, as most road buddy things go, things don't start out smooth, and they don't necessarily progress smoothly, but they get smooth, and then they don't, and then you have the ending. But that's the only way in which you can actually legitimately predict this series.
Yeah, I mean, even Chogham himself, you know, when you made the point about acting to their station, you know, Chogham, you know, despite everything, still has that regal bearing. He's a natural born king, basically. And there are points where he resigns himself to what has to happen. He's not happy about it, but there are points where he goes, okay, well, I have to, you know, get to the place on time where I have to offer up myself. And if I don't, then, you know, everything dies and all the people I care about will die. And I have a duty to do that.
He accepts the fact from his mother he has to go with Balsa. He accepts the facts from Balsa that he has to get rid of all his wealth to make for a harder journey. There's a lot of little decisions that he is forced upon him that he takes, and at the same time speaks to his character at the time because he's not used to speaking back to anyone. He's not necessarily used to being on top of anyone either, which speaks to his character. But he's willing to accept the guidance of elders as his superior. And there's just these lot of little consequential moments along the way that help develop his character to the point that near the end of the series, he's become round enough to look back on all those as we have looked upon him and become a round character.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you could argue that by the end of the series, you have character growth in a lot of different places, and of course you have a lot of character growth with Balsa too, but I would say Chogham probably evolves the most out of everybody, from a scared little boy who's tired and footsore and doesn't understand what's going on completely, but he's going to go along with it, to a young man who thinks for himself, who, you know, is beginning to think like a ruler should think, and, you know, is possessed of an extraordinarily strong mental toughness that he didn't have when he started out.
And, oh my God, how much is that represented in, like, one of the final scenes? He is, and I don't know if we have to say spoilers for a series that's 10 years old, but...
Let's... Are you talking about like one of the very last scenes?
Yeah, it's so important to what you said, though.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about it, because that is such an emotional scene. It kills me every time I see that scene.
It's a goodbye of sorts that, unbeknownst to the people, unbeknownst to Balsa and the crone and the herbalist. They're redirected to meet Chogham at the final scene, and it becomes apparent by the way Chogham addresses his former family and the direction in which he ushers them that he has become kingly in the fact that he can separate personal from state while keeping his own morality.
And after he's reunited with the royal family, after they've resolved the main conflict and main plot point of the story, you know, he doesn't really interact with Balsa, and she sees him one time before this scene you're talking about, and he is not you know, he's being a prince. He's not showing emotion. He's not doing anything. He's just sitting there in his chair with a veil over his face, not saying anything. And then this scene happens that you're talking about. Mm.
But he's not the only static character who grows, because Balsa, who has been a one-note character, she's been the protector, grows largely. Not only, I mean, you see the obvious progression of her to mother, and as she takes on Chagum and, you know, sort of cares for him and helps him grow through his journey and her journey with him. But after she relays the sort of crucial connection between them, her growing up with a protector as well, being ripped from the life she knew, that is a remarkable start of a point of growth between those two, because she grows exponentially as a product, sort of realizing why she's doing what she's doing and becoming stronger for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's through Balsa's growth into becoming more than just a bodyguard to Chagum, but like you said, becoming a mother figure to him as well. Through that evolution itself, she begins to understand her own adopted father figure in a way that she couldn't have before, because now she's experienced and felt what he felt, protecting her all those years.
Can we talk about the flashback episode?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's right there is, you know, sort of demonstrates what the series is in a whole. There's a series where, or a scene where she is cut down in a fight, this is early on. She's cut down in a fight and suffering sort of severe wounds, and while bleeding out, she is hallucinating and flashing back upon a scene she remembers as a kid. And this is one man cutting down another man, one of whom is her protector. And
his name is Jigoro.
Jigoro. And this is overlaid on top of each other in a fact that you really don't know as a viewer watching first time through whether this is happening simultaneously or in a flashback. And it's not until a little later in the flashback that you get a hint of it. But honestly, that is the best part of the series, because it melds memory with the present and sort of the spiritual with the physical. And that is everything the series is.
It really gives you kind of looking back on it after you've seen the series, you're like, oh yeah, there's Balsa's internal conflict literally manifested like right there. You know, because she, you know, just like we, when viewing it for the first time, we don't necessarily understand what's going on. Balsa doesn't necessarily know and understand what all of Jigoro's motivations were either, until she grows into a mother figure and a protector and a guardian for Chagum. And that whole duality and that parallel kind of dynamic, I love that so much about this show. And it's one of my favorite things about Balsa and Chagum's relationship and it's just damn good storytelling, that being able to layer that in, and as she's growing and her relationship with Chagum's growing, in a way her relationship with her late adopted father is growing too, even though he's, you know, beyond her reach at this point. And it's just a beautifully, beautifully done bit of storytelling. And really a credit to Uehashi's ability to weave characters together in a story like that. Just love it.
If it is Uehashi's ability, there's a bit on the DVD commentary where the director and the original author are going back and forth, and the author just says, you know, these are my characters and my situations, but they're not my characters and my situations, but I really love witnessing these new characters in these situations that are so my characters in these situations. And it's just such a beautiful, beautiful commentary on how much the director has taken the core of the novel and implemented it in the anime.
Yeah. No, well, Jigoro does show up in the book. He is mentioned in the novel itself, but there's, I guess, let's talk really quickly about what she means when she's saying all that. So the book itself we alluded to is pretty short in English, and I'm looking at it right now. With the epilogue, it's 248 pages. So you can pretty much sit down and read this in one sitting. Even if you're a fairly slow reader, it's not going to take you very long. What is different between the book and the anime is the middle part, where, in my opinion, a lot of the best plot stuff happens. Pretty much all of that is new and original to the anime itself. So the broad strokes of the plot are, it starts exactly the same. You know, Balsa, you know, has to protect Chagum. They meet up with Toya, who's a errand runner in town, who's awesome. They're trying to get away. The Emperor's secret guards get after them. Balsa's hurt. Balsa, you know, has to rest with Tonda and get healed up a bit. And then they pretty much go straight to the place where they end up in the final kind of third of the series, into the Yaku village, and then head off and deal with the arrival of the water spirit and the end. So there's like a whole bunch of stuff, that was added for the anime, and that's one of the really, I think, unique qualities about Morabito is the story you get with the anime is actually, and this is no knock on the book, it's a good book. The story you get with the anime is much fuller and much richer because you get to see more of the daily kind of life that Balsa and Chagum have, and it makes their bonding more real. You know, if I had read the book not knowing the anime, I don't think I would have come away with the same kind of emotional weight to their relationship as what they have in the anime, because there's no comparison. It's a little, you know, because the book is very long, it feels a little rushed. But the anime builds it brick by brick so well, from the part where they're hiding out in the blacksmith's, this is one of my favorite scenes, where they're hiding out in the blacksmith's shop, and two of the guards come in and they're talking about, you know, swords and what it means to make the perfect sword, and the blacksmith tells them a story that ends up being a story about Jigoro, Balsa's adopted father, and about how he wanted to wield the perfect spear, the perfect blade that would never kill anybody, but he couldn't do it in the end. But then the blacksmith thinks that there might be somebody out there that can wield that kind of blade, and, you know, he's talking about Balsa, and it's so good. That's one of my very, very, very favorite scenes. There's another kind of like festival story where Chagum has to wrestle a kid. And
he doesn't,
the kids
have to. He chooses to. Despite
he chooses to. But from Chagum's perspective, he has to, though.
Well, kind of. It's because what's best about this is it's just very emblematic of the typical pubescent child's rebellion against the mother father figure, and you know, okay, I've been told not to do this. Oh, but I have to do this because, not realizing the greater implications. And what the scene does, or what the situation does in large, it grows Chagum in his growing strength as an individual, and someone who wants to fight for the people, namely his father, but still himself and his nation, but also Balsa, because she's showing restraint as a parent. She says during one part in the scene, like, what would my mentor have done? And you can see her sort of leaning back, and this is a prime thing of the series. It uses visual as opposed to monologue. It's just, oh, he's run away again, I thought he would run away, and she leans against the door, mm-hmm. just looking out, and you know what she's feeling, she's thinking, he's run away, I've got to go get him, how can I go get him, why, what repercussions would it have, and this is perfect parental thought pervade via visual. And it's fantastic. And it's growing, because it's growing her, because she's never had these feelings before. She's never had need for these feelings before.
Yeah. I mean, like, Balsa, they make a point early on in the story to demonstrate two things about Balsa. Is one is she doesn't have a very high regard for nobility, which we find out with her backstory why that is, because a king sent, eight other of the royal guard of Conball, the eight other spears, to kill her. And those are the people that Jigoro had to fight all those years to protect her. And those people were all friends to Jigoro. So it kind of destroyed him inside to have to, murder his friends or, kill his friends to defend this girl. But the other kind of neat thing about all that is that with Chagum, it's like one part rebellion, because he's running away, right? And he's not doing what he's been told to do by Balsa. That's very adolescent. But then also he feels this obligation that he has to go because this jerk face foreigner kid made kind of a mockery of the Mikado, and that's not going to stand because you don't do that kind of thing. So Chagum has to defend the honor of his actual father while his somewhat adopted mother, he has to disobey her to go do it. So it's really funny how, like, these different motivations kind of come together and combine. But to your point, like, the growth for both of those characters in that episode is just really great.
Amongst the episodes where, the filler sort of outstripped the original novel, there was an episode where Chagum has to learn how to gamble, or at least how gambling works.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. That's pretty much the perfect example of how he is allowed to blend into the world. He's constantly protected by Balsa, but allowed to interact with the world. And I love that, because it's a mother overseeing her child, however indirectly, because Balsa is, like, up on a bridge way, way away, while her child and his friend, who is one of Balsa's friends and helpers and one of the errand runners of the village, is kind of keeping watch on him. And they observe this game of chance, where it's not really chance because it's rigged. But Chagum is smart, is scholarly smart, and he recognizes the rig behind the game, and his street chum does not. And as soon as Chagum makes Toya, I think it is, right? Toya?
Yeah, it's Toya, yeah.
Recognize what's going on, Toya becomes enthused and is like, oh, I want to take him down. And they do so, but they do so in a very diplomatic manner with the rest of the people who are sitting around them. And it's beautiful in the fact that, Chagum is growing very incrementally. He's learning to step down his abilities as emperor and sort of use the smarts he has. And I love that. And Balsa's sitting all the while, spear and ready, and just going, when do I use this?
And Chagun, bless him, he can't help but be a prince. Like, he very politely but firmly tells these people, you guys are all stupid because this is not a game of odds. You're being manipulated. And let me show you why. And then he goes through this whole process, and he ends up rallying the crowd to his side because he has that sort of natural charisma. But this episode that you're talking about is the exact point where, upon rewatching it for the podcast, I went, you know what? In my headcanon of spinoff anime that I'd love to see that will never happen, I want a Chagum and Toya detective agency, like Hardy Boys in a Asian-Japanese-inspired fantasy world detective anime. And that's never going to happen. But he was very – I mean, he practically went Conan on them and, like, pulled out the little pipe and, like, just started, like, breaking it down. Mm. It was so great.
And speaking of that, like, there's the complimentary episode where Balsa becomes a tiger. And this is fantastic because up until now, Balsa is sort of a Mary Jane. She is the strongest. She's the keenest. She is untouchable. She has a reputation, but she's managed to become stealthy. How carrying her short spear as she does, I don't know. Because that's a constant question throughout the series. Like, okay, there's a woman carrying a short spear through the village. How is this not instantly recognizable as Balsa? Probably the only fault of the series. Or that everyone is intimidated by her not to say a thing. I'm not sure. But there's this episode where she seemingly has no recourse other than to kill a person, which she has vowed never to do. And also, again, to sort of this series discredit, she thinks she kills him and doesn't, and really doesn't suffer much psychological recourse. There's a little bit of it, but not much. But where the real brilliance in that episode lies is in the school teacher's eyes, because there's a person who she was protecting aside from Chagum, because there was a stone shooter and an old adversary of hers who were threatening the first person who crossed a certain bridge, and the school teacher was going to be that first person. And suddenly the school teacher realizes she's in danger, and Balsa comes to her rescue, more or less. And when Balsa sees that she has no recourse other than to slay him, that's when the school teacher recites this tale of a similar situation where someone lets loose their inner, you know, torment and sort of lunges without humanity at her attacker. And the school teacher sees the same thing happening with Balsa, and she lets her know. And still the same scene plays out. But Balsa withholds, and she's not that tiger, and she comes away feeling she is. And that's a huge emotional development thing.
I want to slightly disagree just a little bit, because I think one thing that's important about – and let me say that is my favorite episode of the whole thing, because – It pits Balsa against the thing that she is trying very hard not to do, which is kill people. Mm. And that is not – that's a very – her ban on killing is a very recent turn of events. It's only in the last couple of years in the story time that she's really decided to do that. In fact, her and Tonda, her you know, kind of lifelong best friend, had a falling out over that, and she left, and only a couple of years later has she come back. And so Balsa, absolutely, in the past, we are led to believe, has killed people. And only after she had this epiphany about, you know, saving lives, you know, when Jigoro passed away, did she start to think, you know, I need to save as many lives as Jigoro killed on my behalf. And so what this whole story kind of does is, you know, to protect this teacher, because this foe she's facing has thought of it, you know, basically kind of recreates the same way that she humiliated him in the past. He pushes her to the point where she decides, you know what, I have no other choice. I have to just embrace that darker part of myself and become the tiger. And she does become the tiger. I mean, she is trying at a certain point in the show, in that episode, she's trying to kill this guy. And like you said, she flat out thinks she does. And I think something happens where she learns that she didn't actually do it. But
yeah, she revisits the spot and the body's not there.
Yeah.
And...
yeah, but like that whole thing is, it's just such a great episode.
But also great about that episode is something indicative of the series is the concentration on fight scene. Well, not the concentration, but
the choreography.
The choreography in general. The fact that,
oh my God, yes.
They don't default to blurry backgrounds and main character lunges and stuff like that. It's seriously just setting two characters in a background and watching them go at each other. And it's awesome. Like, you don't get better sword-on-spear action in anime anymore. It's beautiful.
And particularly the episode with Jigoro, where it's all spear people fighting each other, and the Kambalan way of the short spear is this very athletic, agile, unpredictable movement kind of based style, and it looks a lot like something, you know, and I guess they probably referenced some old like Chinese martial arts movies, but it looks a lot like something you'd see in a Jet Li movie or something, you know, lots of you know, quickly letting go of the spear and turning your body completely, you know, spinning your body completely around to grab it again and come at it from a different angle, and you know, using it to sort of like hop up, and then like there's that one move that Jigoro does where he like, you know, kind of stabs the spear into the ground and hops up on it and flips the blade up towards somebody's face. And it's like, man, it's awesome. And like just the agility of it. And Balsa fights that way too, obviously. But
and there's actually that scene where she's emulating him as a youth with just a bare wooden bow.
Like a bamboo pole, yeah.
And, you know, she's reprimanded for it later. But her emulation of his tactics, that just being put outside of an actual action scene is phenomenal, because you just get to watch the action happen without the action. It's just the movements. The anime cares so much about the art of wielding this weapon that it lets a little girl do it in front of a campfire and an audience, or between a campfire and an audience, where the fact that it's dramatic and it's beautiful, it's art, but it's also part of, you know, something dangerous. And it's just so bloody beautiful. And this attention to detail is carried through in every fight scene you see. Like, every once in a while you might get this blurred background, but it's still recognizable as background. It's not blur.
And also keep in mind, you know, as we've said, this is a 10-year-old show at this point, or is about to be a 10-year-old show. The fight choreography is second to none. I mean, there have been fighting anime that are not as detailed and just lovingly crafted in terms of their fight scenes as Morabito is. And Morabito is, while it has a lot of action in it, it's not that genre, right? It's not at all. I mean, it's martial arts is a big part of it, but it's not central to the story.
Well, martial arts is a means towards an ends here. Like, it's a means of protection. It's a strike last, defend first thing.
Right.
That's really, really driven home by other aspects of the animation, where all the silences, there are so many moments in this anime where there is nothing but two characters looking at each other or multiple characters looking at each other for at least a solid 30 seconds. And when do you get that ever anymore? This is the culmination of the characters you've come to know up until now staring down each other and what that means.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, to tie and compare Moribito to another anime that we both love, this feels like a – this doesn't feel like an anime story. It just feels like a good fantasy story in the same way that Showa Rakugo is just a great drama. It's just a great adult drama. This is the same kind of thing. And I don't know if it's necessarily the source material or the execution or a blend of both. I'd probably lean to being a blend of both. But, you know, this show is so full of heart and so full of emotion. And, you know, it's – you grow to love these characters and you really see – by the end of the series, you really see the love between the sort of the family that these people have earned in each other with Balsa and Chagum and Tonda and Madame Torugai. And it's just so heartfelt. And I dare you watch this and not get emotional, because it will just leave you in tears by the end of the show.
It'll rip you apart.
It will just like Chagum almost was.
There's a lot of visual cues too that ripped me apart. There was the first prince who ascends to the throne, the would be throne.
Oh yeah.
He, as enabled by Chagum, made, well, quote-unquote friends, but really adopted a pet out of something he shot out of the sky. And that actually comes into play not only in direct relation to sort of his final entity in the series, his final departure, how he exits, but also Chagum's saving grace.
It's the same bloody kind of bird that Chagum ends up being saved by at the very end, or actually all of the people end up being saved by at the very end, because they have to have that specific bird has this like kind of fleshy sack under its beak, and like every 100 years they come and they scoop up the water spirit egg and carry it off into the sea, out to the sea, where it's born and it blossoms and it kind of creates all the clouds and the rain. And
mind you, this is usually due to the monsters devouring the Moribito, but can also be done through some other explicit thing. But just the fact that bird comes into play at three specific parts is fantastic in storytelling.
It's beautiful. Beautiful foreshadowing, beautiful symbolism of salvation and redemption. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous symbol. And you know, it itself, the bird, is you know, very graceful.
You will cry. I guarantee you. You will cry.
You will cry, and it will be a good cry.
this is something, and I'm going to say something that will make me a lot of enemies right now. Moribito out Miyazaki's environmental themes, because it is told with such tender, untouching, unflinching non-narrativeness. This entire series managed to make me care more about how I interact with the world than any fantasy Miyazaki has put forth.
And that's precisely for that reason you just said. It doesn't try to club you over the head with the importance of the environment. It
shows it.
You just show, yeah, it just shows it to you and you get it.
Yeah, like the fact that, you know, this egg being born represents water to the earth. And the fact that humans' hubris and knowledge has prevented, or might prevent, this egg from being born, you know, and thus cause a drought on the land for the next 100 or so years until another egg appears, if it appears. That shows everything that you need to consider right there. There's no narrative that needs to be told. It's just the land interacting with the land, and that includes humans. And that's never said, but the fact that humans are inherently considered just another animal in this series is fantastic. And I really think, like, no matter how much you read into other Miyazaki anime, you will never find a better telling of this.
Yeah, like, Miyazaki should adapt more of Uehashi stuff. Yeah, I think.
Seriously. pretty much the perfect combination of material to be adapted and director adapting the material.
Yes, yes. And Kamiyama, hats off to him. But before I sing his praises, there's one other plot thing I wanted to talk about. And then I'll shut up about that and talk about Kamiyama. So the way that they figure out to save Chagum is through Madame Torugai's research. She's basically like Merlin for all intents and purposes. She figures out that there was a spell that would have worked in the case 100 years earlier with a Yaku boy, where they were trying to reach into Nayu, the spirit realm, and pull the egg out into Sagum, the mortal realm. But they didn't get the time to be able to do that before the Nayunga Rochaga, which is the thing that eats and tears people in half, that eats the Moribito. They couldn't save the boy in time. They try it again with Chagum, and the way they do it, it ends up being Tanda, who's Torugai's apprentice and Bulse's best friend slash, he's loved her for all his life. It ends up being Tanda and Bulse reaching into Chagum together and pulling the egg out and saving Chagum together, that gets the egg out of Chagum. Now, lots of other things happen to make that moment happen. But the fact that it happened the way it does is just amazing. Because earlier, Chagum, who's picked up on the fact that Tanda is in love with Bulse, and that Bulse probably is in love with Tanda, she just maybe doesn't realize it or admit it to herself, he starts walking towards the place where he might end up dying, and he starts holding both of their hands. And it's just this... it's just this simple thing, and there's no words. He just kind of looks at each of them, and they look at each other, and there's a lot of that in the series, and it just kind of builds up that emotional energy to where you see them work together hand in hand, literally, to save Chagum's life. And if you don't cry, you're dead inside, and I feel bad for you.
There's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot that makes that scene happen, and I think it's worth mentioning because there's so much visualization happening. From the very first or second episode, the crone, who is very much a Miyazaki-inspired crone, she's got the face, she's got the short body, she's...
Torugai.
Yeah, Torugai. Her bug eyes, her tan skin and wrinkled face, and... you know.
And her gives no fucks at all attitude.
Exactly, I love her to death. she is in one of the first scenes she's highlighted in, ducking her head underwater to speak with the water spirits. And in subsequent scenes, she's similarly pushing her hands into people and face into people. She actually buries her head into Chagun's chest at one point to see the egg. But all this is done purely visually. There's no, oh, hey, I'm looking into this boy's chest, I'm seeing what I just saw up at the knot, the place where I just interacted with the water spirits. No, it's all visual. It's just her ducking her head into Chagum as she ducked her head into water. And that's so very important, because everything in this series is like that. Beautifully, visually told. you don't need to be told anything. You're shown it all.
Yeah. And again, you know, hats off to Kenji Kamiyama for an amazing directorial job. And I seem looking at now Wikipedia says this and it could be wrong, but it says that he wrote the scripts for the anime TV series. So I don't know how true that is, but if that's the truth, then oh my God, that man needs an award specifically for this, because it's such an amazing directorial vision to be able to show all these things visually and really convey so much with just the visuals. And it's just amazing. And the only other thing I've seen him do is Eden of the East. And I loved Eden of the East, but this is so bloody different. But oh my God, like, this is so good. And I hope he does another fantasy at some point in the future, but maybe this is, I don't know how you could do better than this, but it's like last
Old Talking to Radio's episode. I don't like giant robots. I love Voltron. I fucking hate fantasy anime. I really do. And I love Morabito. And even if the series does dissolve into a little too much fantasy babble towards the end, there's, for instance, discovery of evidence that immediately solves a previous ignorance to correct a course that was diverted from originally. Like, oh, we must hurry to Chagum. Oh, wait, the monster won't eat him until dawn. Then a little bear with an egg appears in its belly, the same egg that Chagum is carrying, and, you know, it dies in front of the party, ripped apart by one of those monsters. And, you know, one of the characters says, oh, maybe he won't be so safe after all. Hurry, to Chagum! And that all occurs in like 5 minutes, and it's horrible and over-explanatory. And, you know, that's a rare, rare instance in this series.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. That's entirely warranted. And as somebody that loves fantasy, I mean, like, my entire life, you know, I have all of the fantasy novels and D&D books to prove it. You know, fantasy is the my home as a genre. It's where I live. I will argue with anybody that says otherwise. There is no better fantasy in anime than this show, period. For the quality of the character arcs, the development, the animation, we've talked about the fight scenes, the landscapes, the backgrounds, however, the character designs.
Let's talk about the landscapes, for Christ's sake. Oh my God, the background art, and especially the attention paid to nature. Like, this is what initially grabbed my attention to the comparison with Miyazaki, is the fact that the fields, that mill burning episode, the water mill burning episode.
Oh, yeah.
When the elite guard are running, ducking through the roads of the fields, the inlets of the fields, between these tall, splendid grasses, and, you know, each seems to have their individual stalks and move as such. Like, this is a gorgeously, gorgeously drawn and rendered anime. No matter who's moving or who's not moving, the background is a character here. Like,
oh yeah, and this anime looks so good, even almost 10 years later, that it looks like it could have aired 2 weeks ago, and you wouldn't even know. It's so beautifully done. Visually, there's so much that's added to the source material here, and I really can't understate enough or overstate enough how just an amazing job Kamiyama did directing it, and the production IG staff did bringing it to life. The music is really good. It's got a Larkin CL opening. Another bonus point, because that's one of my favorite Japanese bands.
Oh, I hated that opening. I mocked it every single time it rolled.
Don't talk crap about Hideo and Tetsuo, right?
I wanna shine on you.
Hey, it's like the perfect, like, hokey, sappy thing to, like, set your mood for this show.
Honestly, it is, but still, it's so horrible.
There's so much to rave about and with this show. There's so much.
The only thing we didn't talk about that I actually wanted to talk about was the CG. Cause
the
CG isn't horrible, and it's actually used kind of weirdly appropriately.
Yeah, like, they do a good job of keeping it the hell out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's set pieces where, like, in the king's room, where you have that veil and the king on the stage and then the slight dip down in the rest of the room, which is totally empty, which feels like CG but isn't. You can actually tell that's hand-drawn.
And then there's some of the people walking in the background for some of the shots that is CG, but it's so unobtrusive that you, like, don't really mind.
Yeah, and then there's the army shots. And the army shots are kind of what I loved most about the CG. There were, you know, when you get that huge field of, like, say, 300 warriors all, you know, taking directions and marching in the same tune. But
oh, right.
But each of... I don't know if you noticed also, or if it was just a result of my watching methods, each person's reaction would be delayed slightly, so it looked like everyone having an original reaction within the CG group movement.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and it looked really good, except the fact that it looked like CG.
And I noted that the way that they chose to represent the marching, that stately one step thing takes advantage of how clunky the CG was back then. It's pretty smart of them. One other thing I wanted to mention, and I kept trying to remember and I can't believe I finally forgot, but the first time I watched Moribito, I watched it dubbed. And the second time, this rewatch, I watched it dubbed again.
Really?
Yes. And for me, that is extremely unusual. But I love the dub. I really do. I think the woman who voices Balsa in the dub is fantastic. Like she's got more of like a manlier voice, I think, than the Japanese voice actress. But the Japanese voice actress sounds a bit older, which is cool. Mm. The manly is not the right word. She sounds like
gruffer.
A little bit. She sounds like a woman who's lived on the road and is accustomed to hard work and is tough, you know, but not unfeminine, you know, and just in general, I think the cast does a pretty good job of voicing the characters. And I almost never anymore watch any dubs. I do it if I'm watching something and I don't want to have to, and I'm doing something else, you know, and I don't want to have to focus on it. But, you know, it does let me focus, you know, watching this way did let me focus 100% of my visual attention to the show and the scenes. And that was nice because normally it's about 85, you know, 15. I'm watching most of it, you know, and I'm catching most everything. But it's usually not till I rewatch something. And I've noticed this with Lion, because I usually to review March Comes In Like a Lion, I have to watch it like two or three times. Because there's a lot of symbolism and shit going on in the visuals. And I notice that, you know, if I'm watching something subtitled, it takes multiple watchings to catch it all. But dubbed, I can just watch it, you know?
I watched Tommy Galaxy, believe me.
yeah. Well, I did too the year before, and I had to watch a lot of that twice just to catch everything.
But as for Moribito, like I don't dislike the dub. I started watching it, and I was like, you know what? I never listened to the sub, so I started listening to the sub for this rewatch, and I never stopped because I fell in love with the Balsa's voice actress.
She's got a great voice.
She does. And
I did listen to some of the subtitled, and it was great kind of contrasting those two different takes on the same character. Because I think when I read the book, I tend to think of the Japanese voice actress's voice. Because Balsa in the book feels a bit older, even though because of the script, the descriptive words and stuff, like, give you more detail than what you see in the anime. But but we probably need to get to Twitter questions, of which we have
very little.
Two. So I'm gonna. So they're both from Impassionate K, which is our dear friend Corey of Taiku Podcast. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Corey.
I want to flip the order of his questions because I think his first question is an excellent question to go out on.
Okay.
So his second question, which we're gonna make first, is on a scale of Noah Izumi to Orihime Inoue, where does Balsa sit? Also, have y'all ever read the books? So, as for reading the books, I've read the book. I read the book for the podcast. I've read it before. I don't know who Noah Izumi or Orihime Inoue is.
Wait.
I'm assuming
the former is, I believe, the robots who do the city thing. Pat Labor.
God. Okay.
Do the city thing. Yeah. Bottle of sake. Sorry.
No.
And the former is Bleach's red-haired, busty thing.
Okay. So I'm going to surrender my otaku credentials right now, or my old otaku credentials, as
I
were.
Them up.
I have not seen Pat Labor. I have not seen Bleach. Maybe what he's trying to get to is the whole strong female character bit, right? So where would Balsa rank in terms of female heroines we've seen in anime, in your opinion?
I would put Balsa as pretty much a badass. She's got a chink where her emotions are for Chagum via her relation to him through her own care via her guardian. I think that's her only chink, and I think that's a problem, honestly. She's a bit of a Mary Jane. She's just given a little bit of a dent in which other people's could chip away at. But honestly, I don't have a problem with that because she's badass and I love her to death.
So I would put Balsa in the highest echelons of the pantheon of female anime heroines. You know, as a fantasy hero, she's pretty much what you would expect. You know, fantasy heroes tend to be very overpowered. Not all of them, but a lot of them. They tend to also have some sort of crippling flaw. And I think Balsa's was her inability to, you know, relate to people in an emotional way besides, you know, this kind of, you know, kind of arm's length. Because even with Torugai and Tanda, who she, you know, had known since both of them since she was a little girl, there's this sort of distance that she sort of imposes. And that ability to sort of isolate herself emotionally to a degree, I think, was her sort of character flaw, like you said. And I think, you know, obviously the relationship with Chagum, you know, changes that in her to some degree.
Honestly, I don't know if her distance is a disadvantage. It's wielded as more an advantage.
Not as a bodyguard, because you don't want to get too attached.
No, but her ability to distance her emotions, like that, yeah. That's very analytical. That's very keen to being a bodyguard because you have to analyze situations and people. So that's overall a skill, and that's just one more lumped upon her fantastic visual apprehension, understanding of her own bodyguard's spear-wielding style that she picked up without having trained a day in her life, just watching him, you know.
That's a very like Japanese like samurai thing.
Oh, sure.
Like the Boy and the Beast, that happens too.
Sure, but that doesn't excuse it.
No,
it's
it
just,
doesn't.
It's just one more skill lumped upon her. You know, she is a great mother, and she's almost instantaneously so. You know, and if you want to say that speaks to, oh, well, this is saying all women are inherently mothers, you know, which is also horrible to say.
I don't know that I'd say it was inherent with her. Like I think she had to kind of figure it out.
Did she though?
You know, like I think she did. Like she got lucky in that Chagum's an extremely like easy case. Mm-hmm. You know, he's going to do what he's told. Like,
and there's not many instances where he puts up any sort of confrontation to her that she doesn't seem to understand that needs to just either work itself out or that how she needs to work it out.
I think Balsa does what a lot of parents do. They go back and they look at their parents and they say, well, what would my dad do? And that's what Balsa does. She goes back and says, well, what would Jigoro do? And then there's that point where, then it's later, it's later in the series when they're about to kind of come, they're Chagum and Balsa are about to butt heads. He is tired. And then Tonda offers to let him ride piggyback like she did right at the beginning of the series. And Balsa's like, no, pick up your pack and let him walk on his own. And like, I think in that sense, in that instant, she sort of, to me, that stood out as she had learned everything she could from the example of Jigoro. And now she's learning from her own experience with this boy. And she knows damn well that boy could get up and walk on his own 2 feet. And then she kind of pushes him to do that. But I don't think that she kind of just knew how.
There's a calling on her own experience, and there's a calling of just sort of a maternal experience, maternal intuition. Mm-hmm. But I think she does it too easily is the thing. I don't think any situation presented where there's a real conflict where she fails as either guardian or mother, there's always a situation where she succeeds as either. And I think that's a problem because she doesn't. There's no chink there.
Yeah, you know, like I take your point about her being a bit Mary Sue-ish, but at the same time, the story succeeds in spite of that because of all the different twists and turns and challenges that are thrown in their way. And I think looking at that, that makes it all the more impressive that you're leading kind of protagonist, although, I don't know that there's one protagonist here, but Balsa, is such a overwhelming force as a character that for her to still be challenged through it all, is kind of interesting because what you're saying is right.
Well, I think the most interesting confrontation to her character is that tiger episode. And I don't think anything past that really challenges her.
Not on a character level. On a plot level, things happen. Yeah. But not on a character level.
Yeah.
So his first question, which we'll close out on, is how good is Moribito? And it's all in caps. So I don't know if he's just saying, man, that's really good, or he's genuinely asking. But Ink, how good is Moribito?
So good. Like, seriously, I don't know when I watched this originally. I think I may have come across it on Adult Swim when it originally aired there. Yeah. I gave it an...
Or even aired there.
I gave it an 8 on my anime list way back when I originally scored it. And I really didn't give it much thought since then. I mean, it's always a show that comes up and people mention every once in a while, much less so now. But I always think back on it fondly. And what I remember most, honestly, when I thought back about the series was people not being able to look the royal family in the face without going blind. I remember the empty vessels, these servants of the court who would drape a thin veil over their eyes and pretend not to see or hear anything. And those were the strongest images I retained of this series when I watched it before I ever drank, before I had the very easy ability to forget everything. And after watching it this time through, holy shit, was there so much more. So much more, and really accomplished in so much better way than I've seen so many other anime try to do, and that earned it a perfect 10. Like, honestly, this is, despite, you know, little flaws here and there that might do a 10. Because you watch the series, and it does what it needs to do perfectly. There's a little bit that's regrettable here and there, but no, 10.
Yeah, yeah. For me, I got back into anime in around 2010, and this is one of the very first things I saw. It might have been the second thing I saw, and actually, it was the second thing I saw, because the very first thing I saw was Macross Frontier, so yeah. This is the second thing I saw. This overwhelmed me back then, and it stayed with me all these years. And I don't remember if it was you or me that put it on the list to watch or and talk about for the podcast.
I think it was your idea to put this on the list, and I cannot thank you enough.
I was so happy that we were going to have the opportunity to talk about this, because this is one of my favorite anime. Like, I can't score it like 1 to 10. I mean, it's 10 on Mal, but you know, it's more than that to me. This is an anime that's influenced me as an artist. It's influenced me in as a fan and how I watch anime. If I hadn't seen this, if it had been something, you know, like Elfin Lied or some crap, you know, like my second thing that wasn't a Macross thing, or my first thing that wasn't a Macross thing, you know, I might not be watching anime. I might have just gone, you know, that was a fun era of my life. I don't know. Like it was such an amazing show back then, and it propelled me to continue watching things and find. And my thing where I go on about the art you need. Well, this was the art I needed at the time, and it compelled me to keep going and keep looking. And here we are, 6 years later, almost 7 years later, and it's the art I need again. And it's so it has every bit the emotional force. Watching that last episode, I reacted like I had never seen it before emotionally. It hit me all over again. And just the force of this show, its heart and its you know, excellent execution. It's incredibly imaginative visuals. It's really good just story, and the storytelling in it make this an anime that 50 years from now will still be among my very favorite anime of all time. And I think this anime stands the test of time. When I tell people about anime that think it's all a bunch of, you know, like
tentacles,
panty shots and boobs and tentacles and that kind of thing, this is one of the anime I point them to. And I say, nah, watch this, because this is gonna change how you view anime. Not a lot of titles you can do that with. There are, I think we're in a good era, because there's a few that you can name nowadays that have come out recently, but this is one of those that I will go back to over and over and over. I will show it to my younger siblings. I will show it to, you know, my friends' children. I will show this anime to everybody I possibly can. Because if I'm to like describe an anime that like is most like me and the things I love and are interested in, this is the anime that does it. I mean, it is.
So where can we find Old Taku no Radio for other episodes wherein we talk your ear off for hour plus episodes?
Well, the easiest place to find us would be on Twitter. at Old Taku No Radio. Our website, where you can find the podcast itself, the podcast feed, is anygamers.com/podcasts/Old Taku No Radio. That's where you can find the show, where you can find me, if you're looking for me, God help you, I do occasionally do some writing for Any Gamers. Very happy to have recently contributed Secret Santa and end of the year picks, and I'm sure by the time this is out, we will feverishly be working on 3-episode tests for the winter 2017 season. Also, God help us. Although it looks like, based off of what that B-side episode told us, there he might be helping us. The other thing I really would love to highlight is I have had the very good fortune and opportunity to become a contributor at Wave Motion Cannon blog, which is you can find that on at Wave Motion Cannon. I think it's wavemotioncannon.com for the website. My colleagues, Cannoneers, I'm calling us Cannoneers, probably because they're going to hate that term. We're putting out content on a daily basis, just about daily basis. We just launched a Patreon that will help us defray some of the costs of hosting the servers and paying for the translation articles that you've come to know and love on that website. Ink, where can people find you?
You can find me in the background of Anna Gamers, editing some of our contributors' articles, also contributing some articles of my own. Also co-hosting, as is evident with Sir Jared here, Old Taku No Radio. And I'm officially instilled as Ink over at the Fandom Post, so you can check out some 10 years later articles and other reviews. And also in the pages of Otaku USA Magazine, go to otakuusamagazine.com and subscribe.
Well, thank you guys for listening. What are we covering next?
The Girl Who Leapt Through Time.
Oh, snap! Thank you guys for listening to us rant about this wonderful, beautiful anime, and please go check it out if you haven't. You call it a roto router?
No.
When it gets stuck, is that how you call it?
I refuse to call it a router, though.
A router? What the fuck is a router? Is that like your one New Jersey thing that you say is router? Is that a New Jersey thing? I don't understand Yankee ways.
I think Jersey is about half on router versus router.
Oh God.
But
it's probably those despicable New Yorkers that err on the side of router, I'm sure.
Probably.
Which means that I'm erring on their side, because that's how you say router is router. But anyway, I won't judge. You're talking about Acidokans, I believe?
No, it's Sure You Cans.
Sure You Cans. Oh, uh-huh. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly, because it has cans nice. In it. Get it?
I do, but don't. We might have 20 minutes of bumper here tonight, guys.
Oh, that was so good. An entire show of bumper. Fuck that. We're okay, no more Morabito. We're just doing bumper show. Big bumpers. Keijo-sized bumpers.